All right, we're doing a series on healing relationships. And last week we did why do good people do bad things? Not why do bad people do bad things, but why do good people do bad things? And my suggestion is that denial is the culprit. Well, we have good people, even in churches, who do bad things to each other because of a lack of their ability to be honest, not just with each other, but with themselves. And if you can't be honest with yourself, you're at great risk of being a hurtful person in the lives of other people. If you weren't here last week, we have a video of that you can get, so you can wrestle with that along with us. And today I'm asking a little bit different question, is why do good people have affairs? So this is a troubling issue in our time, but one I think it's important for us to wrestle with and think about. Now, some of you are thinking, well, this doesn't really apply to me. You know, either I've got a good marriage or I'm not in a marriage right now or don't ever want to be married. But I've got news for you. It does apply to you today. After you listen to what I'm saying today, it's about how to be a good person in relationships. What does it mean to be a good and helpful and healthy person in relationships? And I'm going to be speaking specifically about marriage, but I'm really talking about what it means to be a person of integrity in relationships. How do we do that? What did Jesus say about marriage? For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate. Okay. Well, we're really not living up to that, are we, in our society today? The statistics, you know the statistics. You know, you got a 50-50 chance of making this work. And yet he had made some pretty strong statements about how this is supposed to be the uniting of two people. The Protestant church considered marriage to be sacred and holy. The Catholics consider it a sacrament, not to be violated. The Catholics are so big on this, you can't get unmarried. You have to have it annulled. You know, there's no getting out of it. You know, once you've entered into this vow of sacrament, it's permanent. It's lifelong. Unless, of course, we annul it after 20 or 30 years for some reason. You can get out of it that way, but that's just because it never really happened, you know. But the point is that we take it seriously. We have civil laws now that really take marriage quite seriously. Of course, you're all aware of the debate now whether or not this should be between a man and a woman. That's, you know, obviously our society is moving. It's going to be now everywhere. I think it'll be everywhere that marriage will be between people of the same sex, too. That's getting legalized. But the state itself, it takes it quite seriously. There's lots of laws determining how to get in and get out of marriage, how to dissolve them. This is not a simple matter. Everybody takes it seriously. So here's the question that a man named, I'll call Brett, posed to me. Is man really monogamous? You've heard me wrestle with this before. Maybe that's the problem. Man isn't monogamous. His idea is that men should get married and change partners every 7 years. He thinks that's just kind of how it should be. Because about every 7 years, he feels really different about himself and his wife, and he thinks we should just all rotate. And that, since that's what we're doing anyway, why don't we all just say that's what we are? His idea is men were meant to hunt, gather, kill, and procreate. That's what men were designed to do. By God, so let's just go do that. Hunt, gather, kill, and procreate, and switch partners when procreation is necessary. He said, he was serious. I mean, I'm not making this up. He said to me that his wife's a good person and he really appreciates her, but he just doesn't think he wants to be with her anymore. He should rotate. He should be with someone different. And then they should have something good going on for 7 years. You've thought this thought, so don't pretend that you're hearing this for the first time. Monogamy has always been difficult. Jesus also said, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard. Jesus said that, you know that. He said, you know, there's a place for divorce. I know that. It's always been. And here's an interesting book. The guy's name is David Instone Brewer, wrote a book called Divorce and Remarriage in the Church. Very fascinating, biblically based book on what he thinks Jesus' view on marriage was. And he thinks that Jesus had several conditions under which he thought divorce would be a good idea. And it's a very sound and really interesting argument. You know, what are the conditions in which divorce is necessary? And he believed Jesus had, you know, three major things, but several things in his head when he said that. Yeah, there's a time when you should divorce. for the time when that should happen. We know that. Monogamy is difficult. Well, in our society today, we have this idea that that men, specifically men, cannot be monogamous. So why is the divorce rate so great? Why is it that people are turning over? Well, the simple solution is that men can't do it. Men, specifically males, they can't be monogamous. Helen Fisher is the main protagonist in making this argument. She has a book called The Anatomy of Love. Anybody heard of Helen Fisher? She's on, public television all the time, and she is the most referenced authority on marriages and on intimacy and on romance. Match.com hired her, and she created a whole website called chemistry.com, and she is the biggest researcher. She's done more TED Talks than anybody else, and the person that is the go-to person for understanding intimacy and relationships. And her idea is that men are not monogamous. She's studied other animals, not just men, all over the world, and her conclusion is that the reason the divorce rate is so terrible is that men are terrible and they just can't be monogamous. It's in their genes. Helen Fisher, yeah. No, you should read her stuff. I have. I've read her stuff. I've attended conferences with her. I really wanted to hear from the horse's mouth, so to speak, what is your argument for this? Here's some interesting facts about Helen Fisher. She's a 65-year-old anthropologist. She was first married at age 23 for 11 months. Said it was boring. She's had two marriages since then. And when she was asked about that, so wait a minute, you're the world expert on romance. Why do you have three failed marriages? She says, well, none of them were failures. Get where she's going with that, right? She has an older partner, a man she's been living with for 20 years, for 30 years, who's 20 years older than her. But she says, because of our age difference, we have an arrangement, which means she's dating the whole time, you know, other men. But she's got this partner that's with her, because all the statistics are, if you have a lifelong partner, you'll live longer and you'll be healthier. So she has that, but she's also having lots of other guys on the side that are closer to her own age. She's very attractive and dynamic, and you know, I can see why she's able to do this. Her idea is that adultery is statistically common in animals and in humans, and that men, specifically you males in the audience, can't be monogamous. You were, in fact, designed to procreate, and that's why you can't help it. We know that men think about sex more than women. Men have more affairs than women. We know that we talk about men as being dogs, but that's not really accurate, because dogs are very loyal and faithful, aren't they? I mean, there's something wrong about that metaphor. Men want variety, men and females want security, and all men cheat. Not a new idea. You've heard me say this before. The O'Neills wrote a book called Open Marriage back in the 70s. It was top 10 best-selling book for 2 years in America. This is not a new idea. You know this idea. 40 weeks on the New York Times top seller list. I wish I'd written that book. You know, 3.5 million copies sold. They say fidelity is redefined in open marriage as commitment to your own growth. Well, I like that, don't you? There's your easy out. An equal commitment to your partner's growth and a sharing of the self-discovery accomplished through such growth. Okay. In 1977, 5 years later, Nina wrote another book in which she said the longest marriages that followed our ideas in our first book made it 2 years. Sexual fidelity is still an important and necessary attribute of most marriages. That's what she said 5 years later. We tried it, made a lot of money off it, sold a lot of books, kind of didn't work. That idea kind of didn't work. Sexy, but didn't work. What happened to my friend Brett? Well, he had an affair with a younger woman. His wife divorced him. He then came to seriously regret it. Tried to get her back, and she was gone. He spent years working on himself, trying to understand what was I thinking. When probably the best woman I've ever known, and now they've been divorced. Been divorced 10 years now, and he's still trying to find someone who he's as happy with as he was with his wife that he's now lost. and she's now moved on and married someone else. Good people have affairs, and not because marriage doesn't work. Good people have affairs because they don't know how to work marriage. That's why they have affairs. I have another simple solution for why we're having affairs, and it's not men having testosterone. Here's a simple solution as to why we have so many affairs. Marriage is hard work. That's the simple solution. It's simple. It's hard. It's hard to be intimate. It's hard to be a person of integrity. It's hard to be honest. It's hard to show up. It's hard to communicate. Even though it hasn't sold as many copies, I'll recommend another book to you by a man named Stephen Mitchell, who's a psychoanalyst. Can Love Last? That's his book. It's not on TV. Doesn't make it onto the radio because it's not sensational. You know, it's in our genes. And men, you have to go out there and have sex because that's where you're made. That's sensational, isn't that? So elegant and simple, it's just that it's wrong. Stephen Mitchell says that the reason romantic love is difficult, it's not because the romantic love diminishes, it's because intimacy becomes increasingly dangerous. See, over time, you get to know me better, and you have more stuff on me, and I can get hurt more. And so it's increasingly dangerous for me to try to work out a relationship with you. And so the secretary that I don't know very well is not very dangerous. She can't hurt me like you can hurt me. You can hurt me with a tone, with a look. My wife's tone of voice can wreck my whole day. I've given her that permission to be that close to me, to have that much goods on me. So it gets increasingly hard to be intimate with someone. But not because romantic love diminishes and that you need to have variety in your sex life. That's not the answer. I've worked with people in their late 80s who have a very active sexual relationship. Now, it takes longer. You know, things don't move around as fast the older that you get. But it's just as sexually satisfying. You can stay excited the rest of your life if you figure out how to do the hard work of intimacy. You can make a relationship with someone extremely meaningful if you can deal with the dangerousness of a long-term relationship. The O'Neill said there are two things they found in their research. There's a desire for freedom, or I would call it distinctiveness, to be your own person, and the longing for relatedness. We want both of those things. I want to have a person who feels free to be who I am and yet stay related to other people. And if I have those two things, then I can live a long and healthy life. But the problem is that we, at some point, become afraid to be who we are in relationship, and we don't know how to do that with each other because we hurt each other and then we close down. All the attachment research we have, and which we have a lot of now, says that if you have a good marriage, a good intimate relationship, you're going to live longer, you're going to have fewer physical problems, you're going to recover from surgeries faster, you're going to have better emotional adjustment, and you're going to have better sex. If you have a good relationship with your partner. Now, what we used to have is just a statistic that married people live longer. We all knew that. Well, we found out that that's not quite true. No, it's people who have good relationships live longer. People in bad marriages die just like everybody else, you know. If you're in a bad marriage, you're not going to live longer. That's not going to really help you get there. You got to have a good one. You got to know how to deal with the dangerousness of intimacy. You got to have conversations. You got to be open and honest. You got to have connections that help you deal with the adjustments in life. Human beings are not like other animals. We have the prefrontal cortex. And I went to a conference where Helen Fisher was there, and a man named Dan Siegel was there, a neurologist from here, from the West Side. Dan Siegel, maybe some of you know about. He's an expert in understanding brain development and child development and what makes us grow into healthy beings. And Dan Siegel said to Helen Fisher, he said, well, you know, your research is kind of interesting, but it seems to you're talking about everything other than humans. Humans make meaning out of things. It's not just about sex, but it's about what sex means to us. We have meaningful relationships, and we're not like other animals. Other animals have a lot of characteristics. Other animals can think, and they can respond. They seem to have feelings. Other animals even dream. But humans are the only animals who know they dream. There's something about us that's different than every other animal in the way that we think and the way that we relate. And if you're not making meaning out of your relationships, you're not having relationships that are satisfying. So you can't compare us to other animals, not really. There's a point at which the comparison drops off. So the question is not, is man or woman monogamous. The question is how? You know, how do you do that? Because it's hard work. I think that's the wrong question. I have a couple who just came to see me for therapy, Christian couple. They go to church every week, have two Christian kids who are in youth group, committed Christian couple. They're leaders in their community. She just discovered he's been having an affair for 10 years. Now, having an affair really hurts a relationship. But having an affair that goes on for 10 years really hurts a relationship even more. Because it's not just about the sexual slip-up. It's about the lying for 10 years. It's about the dishonesty. And what we're doing now is reversing a decade of dishonesty. And that is really hard. I don't know how it's going to turn out. But it's really, really hard work. As we talked about last week, character is not the ability to be perfect. Character is the ability to be honest about your imperfections. Think about it. If he defined that as character for him, then he would have been honest about his first slip-up. He would have said, you know what? I got bad news. You know, Sheila at work? Ugh. And they would have fought about it and maybe come to therapy and, you know, beat each other up. But what do they do now? She's discovered that he's been dishonest about that and deceiving and doing it here and there and going on trips. They went to Europe. How did he figure that out? Took his girlfriend to Europe. Denial is the refusal to face your guilt and be honest about it. That to be a good person in good relationships does not mean you don't have slip-ups. It means that you're honest about it when you do. Secrets are things you must not talk about. Now, there's a difference between having secrets and being private, right? Privacy means there are things I choose not to talk about. Secrets means there are things I must not talk about. And if you've got things you must not talk about, you need to take a look at your life and find out who there might be in your life that you can talk about these things with. Are there things that you must not talk about to anyone? You're in the gray area of maybe the slippery slope of not of doing something that's out of character. If there are areas of your life that you think you must not talk about. We're making the repair now, and how we do that is through complete honesty. What we're doing is we're reversing the dishonesty. If they're able to do that, and you can imagine how brutal this is. I mean, she's got 10 years worth of questions. I mean, wait a minute. Like 6 years ago when you said you were going here to there, those specific kinds of questions, it's brutal. But the complete honesty between them now is what stands a chance of reversing the damage, the dishonesty that's been done. They have to completely reverse that process. He has to answer every single simple question. Why? So that he can be honest. Being honest now is... She found out. It's all bad news. I mean, confessing would help a little. But he should have confessed it 9.5 years ago. If they can do this, if he can be completely honest now, the statistics are there's a 70% chance that she'll trust him again. If not, it drops to 30. You know, if he says things like, well, you know, that's in the past, and I don't want to hurt you with that, and you need to know that information, and, you know, that's just going to make things worse. That's what the betrayal person always says. The chance of her ever trusting him again drops to 30%. Why? Because he's not willing to be honest. What reverses it is the honesty. When he says, I don't want to tell you, but if you want to know, okay, yeah, we actually went to Europe that weekend. Can you imagine how mad she was to hear that? What that set us back. But in that process of honesty, there's the possibility of restoring character. There's the possibility. He doesn't want to do it, and she doesn't want to hear it, and we don't have a choice. We've got to go down that road. And that's what we're doing. Shirley Glass has written a book that's, I think, the best book in this area called Not Just Friends. You can secretly write that down if you don't want the person next to you to see it. Get the tape. Not Just Friends. Shirley Glass, Dr. Shirley Glass. Most affairs start in the workplace now. The workplace has become dangerous to relationships because we think it starts out as just friends. And when the partner who's suspicious says to the one who's on a slippery slope, well, I'm not comfortable with your relationship with that person at work, and he says, well, we're just friends. Shirley Glass says, be nervous. Be very, very nervous. Because that's where it starts. Most affairs start with friendships. They start at work with people who are in love with the same thing. You know, I really love my work, and she really loves her work, and we're really great partners at this, and all of a sudden that love kind of turns towards each other, you know. You look at the person next to you and go, well, we're both really excited about each other now, you know. It kind of happens that way, where it evolves, and it slips up on you, and you don't see it coming. And I'm talking about good people. There are good people now who are ending up in affairs, and they didn't see it coming. You've gone to these. There are affair proofing your marriage workshops. Have you seen those? Go to the workshop and you'll affair proof your marriage. If you have a good marriage, you're not going to have an affair. That's not true. Good people with good marriages slip into affairs because they weren't paying attention. They weren't paying attention to the slippery slopes and the signs. You know, we're in a culture now. We talked about this last year when I was here. We're in a hookup culture in colleges. Certain colleges where between 60 and 80% of the college students are having sex with people they have no intention of having a relationship with. They call it hooking up. Women don't want men to get in the way of their graduate school plans, so they don't want to have a relationship, but they do want to have sex. So they're hooking up with each other and creating this whole culture where we're not having the same respect for marriage that we used to have. The average age of women getting married is older now than the average age of women having their first child. This year, almost half of all children in the United States will be born out of wedlock. Almost half. They expect in 2 years it will be half. And after that, more women will be having babies not married than women having babies married. Yeah, and 3 years from now. That comes from the older contingency. That's why it shocks us, right? But if you're in college, you'd think, well, that makes sense. We're in a different kind of culture. But we have a new kind of infidelity that's happening now. Good people are having affairs and good relationships in larger numbers than ever before. I'm not talking about thrill seekers. I'm not talking about people who have sexual addictions. I'm not talking about people who lack character. I'm talking about good people with good character who end up having affairs. Because we're swimming in this culture that we live in. And it starts, I said, with emotional affairs, which Shirley Glass calls the people who say we're just friends. And the spouse is uncomfortable and they can't put their finger on why. And my wife's not a jealous woman. I don't know if some of you met her. She's very beautiful and she doesn't have much to be jealous about. But there's a neighbor down the end of the street. She said, you know, you can have lunch with whoever you want, but not her. And it was shocking for me. It's like, she never says that. You know, Well, yeah, she's attractive, and yeah, she's successful, and okay. I've never had lunch with that woman. Because she knew something that I don't know. And I don't want to put myself in that slippery slope. And what I didn't say is, well, we're just friends. I kind of removed that from possibilities of being able to say that. There are some times when we put ourselves in situations where we end up in a slippery slope that catches us unaware. Well-intentioned people who end up betraying their partners and their own moral values do it because they have bad boundaries, not because they have bad marriages. If I made one point with you today, it'll be this. How do you protect your marriage? It's not just by having a good marriage, it's by having good boundaries. By not placing yourself in dangerous situations because you don't know yourself as well as you think you do. I don't know myself completely. So when my wife says to me, you can have lunch with whoever you want, but not that woman, I go, okay. She says, she sees things about me that I don't know. You never completely know yourself. You just think you do. So don't place yourself in dangerous situations. Today, more men are getting emotionally involved in affairs and more women are getting sexually involved in affairs than ever before. It used to be, in the 50s, men got involved sexually with affairs and emotionally they didn't want that. That's changed. Men are getting emotionally involved first and then they get sexually involved. They find that emotional affair is the pathway to the sexual affair now. About 40% of men end up having affairs. Ouch. 25% of women. But only 10% of women and 19% of men think their spouses are unfaithful. You get that? 40% of men have it, but only 10% of women think they're doing it. 25% of women do it, and only 19% of men think women are doing it. What does that say? The word men are more accurate, yeah. And also that we're all underestimating how much it's happening. Most people think they can prevent affairs by having a good and loving relationship, and this, as I've said, is a myth. Internet affairs are primarily emotional. And most people think that affairs, you have to have sex. But men think that. And with I'm working with several couples. The men think it's not an affair because we didn't have sexual intercourse. And we had the first several weeks of fighting about this, and oh, she was so mad, and she threw his clothes down, put all his clothes in the middle of the floor and stomped on all of them and said, and that's how you make me feel. Pretty vivid, right? That's why she didn't burn the clothes, but I'll go with stomped. And he said he confessed everything, and I said, now's the time. You've got to get it all out now. Now's the time. Come clean. 10 years worth of stuff he's supposed to come clean in one session. I was being dramatic, but I'm making a point, right? You've got to come out with it right now. This was 3 months ago. She just found out, and he said, last time we had sex was 2 years ago. Well, the last time they had intercourse was 2 years ago. They had oral sex a month before they came to therapy. That's not sex for men, right? Thanks, Bill Clinton. Yeah. Don't think she wasn't furious when that came out. You're not being honest. No, you're not getting it. It's the honesty that will fix this, not you reshaping history to make yourself sound better than what you actually were. That's not going to help us. What's going to help us is your willingness to be honest. So yes, it's a myth to think that it's only an affair if there's sexual intercourse involved. It's a myth to think that cheaters leave clues. It's a myth to think that you'll be able to tell. Most affairs actually are never detected. It's a myth to think that cheaters are not getting enough at home. That's the problem. The fact is that cheaters are not giving enough at home. And that's why they have affairs. The lack of secure emotional attachment leads people to stray, but it's because they're not the ones doing the attaching that makes them stray. It's a myth to think you'll just know when your spouse is cheating. Fact is that cheaters can turn into Mr. and Mrs. Wonderful all of a sudden in your marriage because they're having affairs, and then you might not know. It's a myth that affairs are because you just married the wrong person. 70 to 80% of people who leave their spouses for an affair divorce. 70 to 80% of the time, if you leave your spouse for the person you're having an affair with, you will end up in a divorce. So were you with the wrong person the first time? The statistic says, I don't think so. That's not the issue. If you're not getting to the underlying issue, you're not solving anything. So what are the three things that characterize affairs? Secrecy, emotional intimacy, and sexual chemistry. So if you're having a friendship with someone at work that's secret, as I defined it earlier, emotionally intimate, and is sexually charged, you're on slippery ground. And you're probably having an emotional affair. And here's the killer. Sharing emotional details about your marriage with someone that you're not married to is a very bad idea. It's a very bad idea. And let me just give you a tip. Talking bad about your spouse makes you look bad. It does not help you. Your credibility goes down. Just in general, just a general principle. Don't talk bad about your spouse. Talk bad about your spouse makes you look bad. And if you're doing that with someone of the opposite sex in a work environment where you have those three things that I just talked about, you are in danger. You are in danger. Don't be talking bad about your spouse to someone that you're having a secret relationship with, meaning she calls you on the weekend and says, I've got a flat tire. You're such a good friend of mine. Will you come help me with a flat tire? Okay, you do, but you don't tell your spouse about it. Right? Now you're getting on a slippery slope. Jason and Michelle, I'll call them, happily married for 16 years. Now, like most people, they don't resolve their fights. Don't feel bad if you don't resolve your fights. Nobody else does either. It's a characteristic of human relationships, you know. John Gottman, who studied more marriages than anybody else on the planet, has come up with this conclusion. We don't solve our fights. That's not why we fight. You think you're fighting to get to a conclusion and get to the answer, and this is what we're going to do. We're going to do it this way. And you fight, you fight, fight, and you come to the conclusion. Okay, well, now we're going to do it that way from now on. That's how we're going to do it. Never happens. What does happen? You fight in such a way that you respect each other at the end of it. You fight in such a way as that you feel connected later. You fight in such a way that you say, you know what? You've got a good point. I don't quite agree with it, but I can see that you've got a good point. That's the best it gets. Where you walk away from the conversation thinking, I'm with a reasonable spouse. I'm with someone who respects my opinion. He's a meathead, but he respects my opinion. He's my meathead. Why are you fighting? You're fighting for connection. You're not fighting to solve things. We are created by God to be connected, first to Him and to each other. So that's why you're fighting, because you don't feel connected, and you're fighting because you want to get back connected. Keep that in mind. Why am I fighting? To get my way? No, you're not. Because if you get your way and you're disconnected, you've lost the fight. What you want is to be connected with the person that you're supposed to feel safe with on the planet. And I married someone who has a lot of different ideas than me. I picked her that way on purpose. Because being married to me would be incredibly difficult. So I picked someone who's different. So that when we fight, she gives me a different idea and I give her a different idea. And at the end of it, hopefully, we feel connected. That's the goal. Well, they fought and didn't solve their fights. She raised the kids, went back to work. Very attractive, intelligent woman, and she hadn't worked for 16 years, goes back to work. And her boss was very appreciative, and she was so excited to have adult conversations all day. That she was working really hard to do a good job, and her boss was very friendly, and so she was really friendly back. And she had just had this way of being flirtatious. And so they would have these flirtatious emails going back and forth, and he would say things that are flirtatious, and she would say things that are flirtatious back and forth. They would have long lunches and stuff together. She had not heard my lecture. He intercepted one of the emails. Yeah, oh my gosh. Yeah, Jason has a history of a short temper. Short fuse, they used to call him. She said, yeah, he's got issues with anger. That's the way she would put it. Blew up. Marched right down to the office, right into this guy's office, and chewed this guy out right in front of the whole organization. He was escorted out by the security. Everybody was humiliated. The boss was humiliated. Now he's thinking he's going to get sued for sexual harassment. She was humiliated. He was humiliated. And by the time they came to therapy, what a nightmare. Screaming and yelling at each other. What a mess. I can never forgive you for what you did to me in our marriage, he would yell. Then where are we supposed to go from here? She would say. She had been excusing his short fuse for years, as that's just the way some guys are, right? He had been excusing her kind of flirtatious way with other men because she was staying at home. It wasn't really that big of a risk. Her affair came out of her own doubts about her own self-worth. She would say, well, I just needed the attention. I needed someone to appreciate me for what I do. And he was appreciating me for what I do. And without a lack of awareness that her own low self-esteem was driving her inappropriate conversations with him, she was placing herself in that danger zone. You've been controlling me for our entire marriage. How many times do I have to say I'm sorry before you forgive me, Jason? How many times? Some of you have had that conversation. How many times do I have to say I'm sorry? There's a difference between righteous indignation and resentment. I'm going to talk about this next week. Righteous indignation is when good people are angry about bad things happening. You should get angry. I'm angry about lots of stuff in life. Because as good people, you have moral fiber in you, and you get mad when bad things happen in society and to you and to other people. That's righteous indignation. Resentment is different. Resentment is the anger I feel when my self-worth has been demeaned. We don't resent earthquakes. Earthquakes don't demean us. We resent people. Because people demean us. When you demean me in such a way that I doubt my own self-worth, now I resent you. I'm not just angry about what you did. I'm angry about the bad feelings I have about myself because of what you did to me. And believe me, when your partner has an affair, it hurts your self-worth. How can you not interpret it that way? That I wasn't enough? I'm not enough for you? That's why you strayed? Now, resentment is different than righteous indignation because it's your protest against your low self-worth. Now, in your own mind, you begin to doubt your own self-worth, and I'm mad at you for that. And so I have to protest it. You're the one who did this to us. You're the one who acted this way. I was the faithful one. But that comes from resentment because now I'm doubting. Am I really good enough to keep my husband, to keep my wife? And that doubt about your own self-worth drives resentment, and resentment makes it very difficult to forgive. Righteous indignation doesn't. Resentment does, because the doubt now is about you, not about the other person. Do you get that? That's really important. I'm not just angry about what you did. I now resent you because I feel bad about myself. And you did something to make me feel bad about myself. And now I need to protest that. Jesus said, "Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own? First take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck out of your brother's eye." That now becomes psychologically brilliant, doesn't it? This guy had a PhD in psychology, you know? Yeah.
Could you say a few extra words about resentment? If, very specifically, if you are feeling resentful and you're unaware that it's dealing with your own self-esteem, could you explain that a bit more?
Yeah, I'm going to do a whole hour on that next time I come, because that's so critical. Where the whole hour is going to be on understanding resentment and forgiveness. But I wanted to introduce you to that concept because it's critical when dealing with affairs. Because what becomes toxic is when you don't realize what I'm really dealing with is now the damage to my own self-worth, and you're just focused on, you know, the speck in the other person's eye, when really the issue is now, I don't know if I'm a lovable person. I don't know if I'm attractive enough. I don't know if I'm smart enough. I don't know if I'm enough. That drives your anger towards the other person. You got to deal with that. And we're going to spend a whole hour on that next week. And I think I have some CDs on that here, too.
Yeah. In 2 weeks.
Sorry, yeah. Thank you. 2 weeks. Don't come next week. I won't be here. Well, come next week. I just won't be here. You know? Don't come to this room. Go. You're going to listen to him, not me, next week. So they both, Jason and Michelle, needed to be more honest with themselves about themselves to get out of this. He had been angry, and he needed to look at his short fuse for his whole life. It's because of his own self-esteem issues. He was raised with an abusive father, and so now he's not going to take that anymore, and he's just angry all the time about that. He needed to look at that. She needed to look at her reasons for acting inappropriately at work. It had to do with her own self-esteem and the low self-esteem she had, and then how that got stimulated in their resentment towards each other, right? And once they were able to be honest with themselves about themselves, we could round the corner and now deal with the damage that had been caused. Fortunately, they caught it early, and that's one that's fixable. They're all fixable. It's just the statistics get worse. The more lies you tell, the harder it is what I'm saying. Good people do bad things when they're not honest with themselves. And that's what we want to change. Oh, I'm running out of time. Don't stop. Got 15 minutes to squeeze in 5 pages. So why would a good person have an affair? They're not just thrill seekers. They're not just sex addicts. They're not bad people doing bad things. They're good people doing bad things because of a lack of awareness of themselves. The forbidden fruit, Dave called it. The need for adult conversation and to be appreciated, Michelle called it. But a lack of awareness about themselves. Remember the story of David and Bathsheba. David, a great man of power, he was up on the rooftop and he saw Bathsheba. Apparently she's pretty attractive. So he has to have her. He has her husband killed. They end up having a baby. They lose that baby. He repents of that and he's honest about his sin. This is critical. "Create in me a clean heart, O God." Remember that passage? One of the greatest passages in the Old Testament. That's David talking about his sin with Bathsheba. I'm honest about it. I'm sorry. What a schmuck I was. They have another son, Solomon, the wisest person on the whole planet. Out of really bad, broken relationships can come really, really good things if you're willing to be honest about your sin. Good things can happen. David, the only man in the whole Bible that God said is a man after my own heart. Why? Because he's honest. willing to be honest. But the sins of the father are handed down to the son. David had a very beautiful daughter named Tamar. Amnon, his oldest son, stepbrother to his sister, lusted after her and basically raped her because he saw a beautiful woman and he took her, just like his dad did. And here's an interesting thing, interesting passage. This is in 2 Samuel 13. And after he had been with her, then Amnon hated her with intense hatred. In fact, he hated her more than he had loved her. And Amnon said to her, "Get up and get out." "No," she said to him, "sending me away would be a greater wrong than what you have already done to me." But he refused to listen to her, and he called his personal servant, and he said, "Get this woman out of my sight," and bolt the door after her. There's a difference between erotic sex and eroticized sex, and you need to understand that. Erotic sex is the sexual feeling I have for someone with which I have a good relationship. You're designed by God to want to be physically close to people that you have good relationships with. It takes time to develop an erotic relationship. Relationship where it's based on good communication, it's great, it's based upon honesty, it's based upon closeness. And then you want to have sex with that person. Eroticized sex is sex you want to have with someone with which you don't have a good relationship. We want to have eroticized sex with movie stars that we don't know, or rock stars, or people at the office that we're not sure they would accept us. You know, and if that woman would accept me, then I'd be really cool, you know. So eroticized sex is based on a tenuous relationship and based on insecurities in you. That drives the whole porn industry, which is a billion-dollar industry. It's all based on our bad feelings about ourselves. And so we want to have good feelings, eroticized sex, to cover over our bad feelings about ourselves. It's been going on for a long time. Amnon was not dealing with his bad feelings about himself, whatever insecurities this guy had. He thought he could solve it by getting the most beautiful girl in the room to have sex with him. You had to rape her to get it, but he thought, that'll give it to me. And once he had it, he realized it didn't give it to me. That wasn't giving me what I was really looking for, the repair of my own bad feelings about myself. So he needed to get rid of her because she was a constant reminder of how he still felt bad about himself, and that didn't work. Eroticized sex is at the core of affairs. You're trying to solve emotional problems, doubts about yourself, through an eroticized relationship with someone else. And I've heard all the sayings like, "I feel like I've known her my whole life. No one has understood me as well as she understands me. You know, we just finish each other's sentences. My wife never understood me as well as she understands me." And I want to say, you're on crack cocaine. It's the same thing. It's the same thing. Eroticized sex stimulates the same area in the brain that crack cocaine does. And so you're fooling yourself just as much. And I've talked to crack cocaine addicts who say the same thing to me. "You don't understand. I really need this. It really makes me..." No, it doesn't. Maturity requires character. And erotic sex with someone you've known for years requires character. And I have to tell you, health is boring. It's just boring. You know, I've consulted on a couple of television shows, and we've talked about, you know, how to make the show interesting, and I keep trying to explain to them what a healthy relationship is like, and they keep saying, "Well, that's boring." Who would want to watch that? And one, I actually was in the scene, with the person, they were actually filming it, and they fired me afterwards because it's like, this is just not interesting, you know? Trying to get people to relate to each other and connect and feel calm is boring. What's exciting? Pathology and something going wrong and danger and trying to resolve something that's not working. We've got to have a conflict that we're resolving. That's interesting. So we're all out there messing up our lives with eroticized sex because it's exciting. Is eroticized sex more exciting? Sometimes, yes. But the people, as I said earlier, who live longer, who are happier, and who actually enjoy sex more are the ones who have erotic sex with a partner they trust and know has their back. That's the person who's going to be there and wait for you in the waiting room. Did you know that people recover from surgeries better because someone's waiting in the waiting room? You knew that, right? Just having somebody in the waiting room. And here's another thing. The person having surgery doesn't even have to really know. Isn't that interesting? We've got people who go to waiting rooms and pray for people to recover from surgery and they get better. I can't explain that. Well, I can, but not scientifically. So how do we recover? How do we recover from an affair? Well, we have to understand this difference between righteous indignation and resentment, because you're going to be righteously indignant about what happened when you discover it, and you should be mad about what happened. But if it goes over into resentment, where now you're angry because you feel doubts about your own self-worth, you've got some work to do. You need to dig down into your own feelings about yourself and ask and try to sort that out. And that's tough, because it gets all mixed up. You should be mad about what was happened, but why? And it's going to go back and forth. Some days it's because I feel bad about myself, and some days it's because it was just wrong. What you did was just wrong. What you did to our kids, our family, your vows. But you got to do that work. And that's, like I said, we're going to talk about that next week. Job 5:2, resentment kills a fool and envy slays the simple. Making a distinction between resentment and righteous indignation is important. God was angry all the time. There's more references to his anger than his love in the Bible. Did you know that? There's nothing wrong with being angry about wrong. You should. But having resentment, that'll kill you. And you need to know the difference. We'll talk about that when I come back in 2 weeks. And then there are certain things you can do. I'll throw this in just because I have a few minutes left. An affair is a betrayal. If you have been in an affair, you have been traumatized. And dealing with trauma is always difficult to do. It is a psychological trauma. When you trust someone and the person you trust violates that trust, it's traumatic. That's why in the state of California, I'm required by law, if someone mentions child abuse in their session, to report that. That's the one thing where I have to break confidentiality. It's the one thing. Why? Because violating the trust of a person in a vulnerable situation is now, we know, so damaging, somebody needs to do something right away. That's what happens in marriage, that same kind of trauma. You have placed yourself in a vulnerable position with this other person, and they have violated you in that same traumatic way. They have violated your trust and your vulnerability. Jesus said, if anyone causes one of these little ones, those who believe in me, to stumble, it would be better for them to have a large millstone hung around their neck and thrown into the depths of the sea. That's a pretty violent guy, don't you think? Should we do that to child abusers? What do you think? Should we do that to everyone who's had an affair? The point is, you don't want to violate trust and vulnerability. It creates damage. Jesus knew that. We now know that. You should know that. You have something to recover from because your trust has been violated. It violates what we call the absolutisms of everyday life. It's a big word to say that we all believe in certain things. We all naively agree to believe in certain things. I say to my children, good night. I don't know if I'm going to see them in the morning. I don't know if they're going to have a good night. I say that anyway. I pray that God keep them safe and sound. Every night I pray with my children. God protect our happy home. In Jesus' name, amen. I don't know if that's going to happen, but do I pray that? Yes, and it creates a sort of a naive absolutism that we believe and we trust in these things. And when that gets violated, it shatters us. We're shattered. Wait, I trusted you. You vowed before God that you were going to have my back the rest of our life. Till death do we part, you said. And now I'm shattered, and I've had to restore myself because my belief in that has been shattered, and it's psychologically traumatic. Well, how do we recover? The first thing you need to do is to deal with the dishonesty. Denial must be broken down. You have to tell the truth, and I mean about everything, all the details. Now, in the beginning, you can't answer questions like, why did you do this, and how could you do this, and should we stay married? I mean, those are harder questions. Asking what you want when it first happens is too complex. But you can say how you feel, and you can answer questions what you did. And those questions, every single one of them, need to be answered. Your old marriage is over. That's gone. You're never going to get that back. You're as good as divorced. That's gone. But what you can do is create something new. We believe in a redeeming God, a God who can redeem anything, like we talked about last week. God redeems people in prisons with death sentences. He can redeem you. You want to be honest and realize that what happened here is damage that needs to be talked about fully and completely. And remember, confronting your spouse is not the same thing as attacking your spouse. So there's different things. You don't want to set traps for them. You don't want to You want to give yourself time, once you've discovered this, to maybe even write it down, what you want to say. And when you confront them, have an idea of what you want out of it. You want them to admit it? You want them to stop it? You want them to be honest? You want a divorce? What do you want? But you have to figure out why. Don't just blow the person's doors off. That's not going to help you get where you want to get. And realize that trauma recovery is an oxymoron. You never, ever get over it. You just get better at dealing with it. You know, you integrate it into your life. We integrate the trauma into our life. I don't like the word trauma recovery. There's people who do trauma recovery. It's like, that sounds like at some point you're done. No, you just get stronger. And the memories get easier to deal with because of your strength. The unfaithful partner must move towards the pain. And you don't get to decide when they forgive you. It's not your choice. It's up to the other. The ability to tolerate the pain and make meaning out of the suffering is what facilitates the healing. You've got to make sense out of it. Like I said, we've got the prefrontal cortex. We've got to make sense of this. And that can take years. But you start the conversation. And this is key. You reverse the boundaries. If you're having one of the ongoing affairs, like the 10-year one I was talking about, where all the secrecy was with the affair partner and there was nothing but, you know, lies, with the marital partner, you reverse that. There's absolutely no contact. And if you work with this person, there's absolutely no personal contact with this person anymore. And now this is completely open. I ask any question you want to ask. And none of this, I'm afraid it'll hurt you, or, you know, it's really not good to go into the detail. Why are we hashing it? No, you don't get to play that card. You just answer the questions. And the affair partner gets to ask, the damaged partner gets to ask anything they want for the purpose of what? Restoring honesty. Restoring honesty. It's not really about the details anymore. It's about, are you willing to be honest? Are you willing to honestly answer whatever questions I've got? Rebuilding trust is the foundation of the repair. And this can take years. You won't trust his promises anymore. Didn't work the first time. So what can you trust now? That you're with someone who's willing to be honest. Not promises, not I'm sorry's, but honest. That then develops a new kind of relationship. And if he or she grasps how much hurt they have caused, then maybe this will keep them from doing it again. Not just promising that they won't. Emotional honesty leads to increased trust, and that's what rebuilds the character. And it is possible. I've seen it happen. People have had long affairs who could rebuild trust and honesty and integrity in their relationships and become who God wanted them to be. What am I saying? Love is not enough. You can't just have a good marriage. You can't just have a good relationship. You've got to have good boundaries, and you've got to know that emotional affairs lead to sexual affairs. And you've got to be smart about it. And if your spouse says, I'm not comfortable with you having lunch with that person, you go, okay. You say, I'm going to go with that because there may be something about me I don't know. I do not know myself fully. And I've had 20 years of therapy. And some of that's marital therapy, some of that's group, but I've been in the therapist's office many, many years, and no one knows themselves completely. That's an arrogant thought to think you do. Attraction is normal. Don't be in denial about it. But don't fantasize about someone else. Don't flirt excessively at work. And don't talk bad about your spouse, especially to someone with the opposite sex. Genesis 2. God said, you know, it's not good for man to be alone. Now the Lord had formed out of the ground all the wild animals and all the birds in the sky. But for Adam, there was no suitable helper found. So the Lord God caused the man to fall into a deep sleep, and while he was sleeping, he took one of the man's ribs and then closed it up there. And then the Lord made a woman from the rib he had taken out of the man, and he brought her to the man. And the man said when he saw that, this is now bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh, and shall be called woman, for she was taken out of man. And that is why a man leaves his father and his mother and is united to his wife, and they become one flesh. Adam and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame. That's the key verse. There's a kind of transparency that happens, that you were created to happen, between you and the most intimate people in your life, that you could be totally naked with each other and feel no shame. That's what you were created for, those kinds of transparent relationships. They're hard to do. You're not going to have very many of them. But when you do that, you're living in the image of God on earth. That's what we were created to do, to have that kind of connection, that kind of honesty. And marriage is that. I think that some theologians have said that is God's attempt to place on earth a metaphor for how God is. He's relational, God, Father, and the Holy Spirit. So he's created marriage for us to recreate that kind of intimacy. So is man basically monogamous? The answer actually is yes, created to be. But monogamy is hard. And why do good people have affairs? Because of denial. Denial of who they're created to be and how honest they can be. I'm not saying you should be perfect. We slip up. I'm saying you should be honest. You can't control whether or not you're perfect. You can control whether or not you're honest. And then you have your best shot of being people of character and having relationships that work. Like I said, we've been talking about marriage, but it applies, as you can see, to all relationships too. That kind of naked honesty you were created to be able to do, and it's the most powerful way to live on the planet. All right, next week we're going to talk about what happens when you can't do that. We're going to talk about forgiving others, and most importantly, we're going to talk about forgiving ourselves, because we're all guilty on some level. Now, we've run over time, but I'm going to go for 60 seconds worth of questions here. Anybody have a question they want to ask? And then you got to go. You got to scoot. Don't go into a long-winded story about your affair.
It's an aphorism. I've heard this one before. Holding on to resentment is like drinking poison and waiting for the other person to die.
That's exactly right. Drinking poison and waiting for the other person to die. Yes, there was one over here.
When you're a part of a corporate environment and people in the workplace are having affairs, or
yep,
as members of the public, and if officials are exposed to having affairs, what is our role as far as being judgmental toward them?
Well, I don't think we should be judgmental, period. Now, I do think we should be wise. And what I'm not saying is that we need to police everybody else's relationships. What I am saying is we need to police our own. And what you participate in, and whether or not you want to go with the guys to the strip club, you know, because that's where all the guys are going. You got to make choices. You know, you want to place yourself in that atmosphere. Do you want to laugh at certain jokes? Do you want to participate in certain conversations? You're going to have to make those choices all along the way. They'll get where you're coming from when you're not laughing along. But should you judge other people? No. But what you should do is be discerning and decide what atmosphere you should place yourself in. And if you're in a position of responsibility, what are going to be what's going to be the corporate culture you want to create? You know, and are you an influence of helping create or influence the culture? That's a more complicated question. Okay, I know we've got to stop. I'm going to hang around. I'll still be here. You've got to go to church, and I'll see you in 2 weeks.